Hello, friends. So glad you've joined me today. Greg Kokel here, the host of Stand to Reason. And it is the end of August, Tuesday the 31st when I'm broadcasting. That means tomorrow's the 1st. And you are getting this, I guess, on the 3rd, Friday. But many of you will have already received the Solid Ground coming out September 1st, which I have titled The Evening News. Now, there's a reason I titled it that way, and part of the reason I'm talking about it right now is because there are many of you who are listening who have not gotten it because we don't know who you are. And I want you to read it for your benefit. It, not for me. It's free. So we're not getting anything from it except for the satisfaction of making a difference in your life. But I have never been more aware in my life as a Christian, and 4 weeks from today is my spiritual birthday. I'll be doing a show on my spiritual birthday. I'll be 48 years old in the Lord. And I never in my wildest imagination as a growing Christian in 48 years, as a person involved in training the body of Christ, as an apologist, somebody who cares about making the case for classical Christianity and classical Christian values, knowing the pushback that what I used to say is we're getting a full court press in every area where Christianity is vulnerable, never did I expect that we would be where we're at now in terms of the tidal wave, the tsunami of ideological challenge to the Christian worldview. Okay? I guess it means the good news is I won't be out of a job for the rest of my lifetime. But the bad news is, of course, is that this is not healthy for our communities, and it's a challenge on the body of Christ. But what I was saying a moment ago is I have never been more aware of the spiritual dimensions of the warfare. And I have talked with you in the past about how I often think that spiritual warfare is somewhat misconstrued, and it is characterized as power encounters, praying in a certain way against the devil, which I'm not putting down, but I think we miss that the bulk of spiritual warfare, biblically speaking, this is when it talks about it, what we draw from the biblical teaching on the capability of the spiritual enemy, it is not principally a power encounter, it is principally a truth encounter. When it turns out that the whole world lies in the power of the evil one, that's 1 John 5, that they are held captive by him to do his will, that's 2 Timothy chapter 2, that the devil deceives the whole world, that's Revelations 12, verse 9, I think, and that he has blinded the eyes of the unbelievers, that's 2 Corinthians 4, we realize that we are up against a formidable foe, and that our job in spiritual battle is, as 2 Corinthians chapter 10 says, to cast down speculations and the lofty things raised up against the knowledge of God. That's what Paul there in 2 Corinthians 10 describes as the powerful weapons of our warfare. They're not of the flesh, divinely powerful. What does that mean? Next verse, we are casting down speculations, tearing them down. Lofty things raised up against what? The knowledge of God. What's the first piece of our spiritual weaponry? I'm looking at Ephesians 6 right here. The full armor of God. Having put on, stand firm, therefore, having girded our loins with what? Truth. Truth. It's a truth encounter, principally. And the rest of the armor, most of it, has to do with elements of truth that we need to be firmly convinced of in order to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. And this brings me to the issue of the September issue of Solid Ground, titled The Evening News. Now, if you have not read it yet, read it. It'll come in your mail should be there already. It'll be emailed to you if that's the way you requested it. And if you haven't requested it yet in one way or another, go to str.org. That's our website. On the homepage, upper right-hand corner, there's a mysterious box that says subscribe. I think that's what it says. I'm going to look at it right now just to make sure I'm not losing my own aging mind. Yes, and there it is. Wait, where is it? First thing I see here is Tim Barnett, Mr. Barnett. It says subscribe. It says subscribe. You know, punch the box, follow the prompts. Now, you may not get this September's, this month's Solid Ground, because you'll get the next one and the next mentoring letter coming out a month later. But you can read the Solid Ground right there on the website, or if you have the app, it's always loaded on the app, the free STR app. Get that too. The reason I want you to read this is because, well, it's the same reason I want you to read them every month, is because I'm giving you something that will mentor you to withstand the schemes of the devil. The devil has schemes. And there are individual schemes that are being played out, and I've written about this before and talked about it, but there's a bigger grand story of how the devil is working hard to undermine the good world that God created, and all the details of the structure of the world, the way God made it, in order that human beings made in the image of God may flourish. When God said all that he made was good, he meant that everything was just so. Everything was perfectly suited for each other, working together harmoniously. Now, that changed when the world got broken at the rebellion. But when God said he made them male and female, that was a good thing, because human beings are male and female, and living according to that is a way of living in which human beings flourish. And if we do not live according to that, then we do not flourish. What the suicide rate for transgendered people is something like 27 times the average. And by the way, that's not because Christians are putting these poor people down so much that they want to take their life. Christians are not allowed to do that in this culture. Everywhere they turn, they're getting support. And in Sweden, where there's no cultural resistance at all to that, the suicide rate is still high in the same neighborhood as for here. Why? Because this isn't the way human beings were made. This is a terrible condition. And by the way, those who are transgendered know that. That's why they say, I feel like I'm a woman in a man's body, or vice versa. They know that something is wrong. They just think that their body is wrong instead of their beliefs being wrong. No, their body's just fine. It's their beliefs that are broken. And we should have sympathy for people like this, but not sympathy expressed itself as enabling the brokenness and further brokenness, but rather trying to help them. Now, I'm not campaigning about this issue right now. I'm just making the point that God made the world a certain way, and that way abets human flourishing. And when we deviate from that way, then we don't flourish. It's not good. It's bad. It's bad for us. It's also evil in the sense that, or at least an expression of the brokenness with evil in the world, because now we are campaigning against God's design. I'm not saying that people who are struggling with just gender dysphoria are, that the struggle is evil themselves. I'm saying that their condition is a result of an evil brokenness in the world, and to champion the broken thing is evil, because that's setting oneself against God. And when God says, chapter 2, you know, that man left his family and cleaved to his wife, the two become one flesh. The way Jesus put it in Matthew 19, one man, one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime. That's God's plan for marriage. You deviate from that? I'm not even talking about same-sex marriage right now. Just deviate from the general plan. You know, like no-fault divorce. Did that help things? No. That further disrupted the foundation of society, which is the family. The good thing that God established for human flourishing is now disrupted, and guess what? We don't flourish as much. So, back to the evening news. One of the things that I have been trying, I have been developing, I mean, not trying, I think I succeeded in the writing in Solid Ground this year, starting from January and all the way through this issue that just came out at the beginning of September, is to track a trend in our country that is against human flourishing. What's the right word? I'm struggling for language here now to make my point. It diminishes human flourishing by diminishing human freedom and by increasing totalitarianism in our midst in a lot of different ways, and a totalitarianism that enforces lies upon our culture, lies that are contrary to the way God made the world, and you don't need a Bible to figure a lot of that out. Just look around you. This is called common sense. But people are blinded, and they believe the opposite of common sense. They believe the opposite of what is true right before their eyes. And they campaign in favor of that and against the truth, and they do it vigorously and viciously, sapping our freedoms in the process so they can do it more vigorously and more viciously. But this isn't a humanly inspired enterprise. It's a spiritually inspired enterprise. It is a doctrine of demons, so to speak. It's a scheme of the devil. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Look at the four ways that Paul puts that in Ephesians 6. It's against rulers, powers, world forces of darkness, spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. And they're blinding human beings. They can't see it. Well, as I've developed this idea and then talked about the encroachment of falsehood by relativism coming to roost in every single area of our lives, and I refer to that as the primal heresy because essentially that's what happened at the fall, not God's objective truth, my subjective truth. You do you? That's the fall. There you go. That's the fall. You do you. That's what Adam and Eve believed. Okay, we're going to do us, not God. Our truth, not the truth, not God's truth, not the world out there, but what's inside here. And then the disruption of these different things that God has established for our flourishing. And in the last 10 years, but especially accelerated in the last 5, 4, 3, 2 years, 1 year. I mean, it's just increasing its velocity every year. The encroachment of totalitarian forces from the culture and also from the government upon us to distort truth, promote a lie, and to diminish human flourishing. That's what the devil wants. And in the evening news, I lay out that scenario. I spend a couple of paragraphs to say, here's the big picture. What I'm giving are snippets of news throughout the piece, confirming the series or the point of view I'm advancing in the series for this year's Solid Ground. But I want you to see the big picture of spiritual distortion, the schemes, if you will, of spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places that are deceiving people. I see the big picture. So that you can see how these smaller pieces fit into the big picture. And that's what it's about. It's just helping you see this. I hope in the Lord that followers of Jesus are becoming wiser. They are becoming more insightful. They can see what's happening. It doesn't require some special spiritual discernment, like I talked about in the last show with Connie. It requires a knowledge of the truth, and when you see the truth and what the truth is and how it relates to our lives and to our world and a worldview that encompasses all areas of Christianity, then you can see how the foreign view is sabotaging the way that God purposed for the world. And it's just so, so obvious to me. Everywhere I turn, I can see it. I can see the lies. Now, I'm not a dour person. Nobody knows me. Who knows me, I think, would ever say that. I'm trying to be realistic. But I have, as I mentioned, I never expected what I'm facing now. And for many, many years as a Christian, for decades as a Christian, I had a pretty good sense of what we were up against. You have the church and you have the world. You have the truth and you have falsehood. And then you had even in areas of the church, the liberals, you know, that had been around for a long time. They started emerging in churches in the late 19th century. And that's when critical theory, not critical theory, but the higher critical school kind of found its feet attacking the authority of the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the historical Jesus, the quest for the historical Jesus. Of course, what they meant is not the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but the real guy who lived, who somehow inspired these fanciful tales, the real guy who was morphed into the supernatural Son of God. You know, that's what they were looking at then. So I was aware of that. And, you know, the church was standing firm, and we had good people that were standing against that kind of stuff, although many of the mainline churches, they, you know, took a hike going along with that stuff. But there, in a certain sense, it was way out there. It was on the fringes, and it just seemed manageable as a Christian worker and apologist, all right, is manageable. Now I never expected. The barbarians are not at the gate. They are right in our midst. I'm thinking of an image of the Lord of the Rings, and we watch these movies a lot on disc, and especially my eldest daughter, and we were watching The Return of the King, and where Osgiliath, the little village of the hamlet, or not, city there on the river, on the across the plain from Minas Tirith, and this plain where the Battle of Pelennor Fields was fought, a big giant scene, unbelievable cinematography and everything they did, special effects, just I never get bored watching that. But there is a scene where the bad guys, the orcs, they break through and they overwhelm. They're not just on the other side of the river. They're not just coming across. All of a sudden, boom, they break in and they overwhelm, and the soldiers have to retreat and across the plain and back to the gates of the city for safety. But I that's kind of the feeling I have right now in the church. The gates have been broken into, and we're being overwhelmed by orcs. That is, people who identify themselves as Christians but deny virtually everything that Christianity stands for, historically, classically. Why don't they just start their own religion? Call it something else. Don't call it Christianity. But that's part of the linguistic distortion. Anyway, this is the warning, the warning that I've been trying to offer to the church this year, and as time goes on, will continue. I'm on your side. Those beleaguered Christians who are standing tall for the truth, and we're on your side at Stand to Reason. Don't be taken in. Do not be confused. The world is confused. There's no reason for you to be confused. And I hope that the evening news, which now many of you have, along with the other things I've written this year, will add up to moments of clarity and insight about what's going on in our culture that we have been sent into to stand tall for and to shine a light so that people could see the truth, if God permits. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking. And we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRAsk. That's hashtag STRAsk. No, I'm not really an end times guy. When I first became a Christian, I was kind of into that, kind of being tutored under Hal Lindsey the first few years of my spiritual life. But I moved away from that, and I figure the fulfillment is the final interpretation, and I'll let God worry about when Jesus is going to come back again. But, you know, I have been thinking about something in light of my comments a moment ago in this deluge that we've experienced now in the church. In 2 Thessalonians, when chapter 2, when Paul is talking about the coming of the Lord, which he calls the day of the Lord in this particular passage, he says, don't be disturbed if somebody says the day of the Lord has already come. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first. And then he has more to say about it, but notice he says the apostasy. The apostasy is when the church, writ large, falls away. And right now, boy, I've just never seen anything like it. There are massive numbers of wonderful Christians in fabulous churches, okay? But those churches in many ways are being now the foundation is being eaten away by a combination of confusion about gender, wokeness, and confusion regarding sexuality. And it is unbelievable to me how fast so many Christians are falling into the world with these ideas. And these are not minor things. They are big things. And things are going to get harder for those who stay true to Christ and don't, like Pilate in Mark 15:15, you know, give in to the mob, wishing to please the crowd. If we wish to please Christ, it's going to be hard. And so the winds are going to blow onto the church, and a lot of this chaff is just going to blow away. There is, you know, there are tares in the church, and chaff, it's just going to blow away. So that means a lot of churches are going to trim down to fight and wait when those faithful pastors stay true to Christ and to his revealed word on these issues that are being taken exception with by so-called Christians, largely now members of the progressive church. Incidentally, I highly recommend you take a look at Alisa Childers' book, The Magnificent, Another Gospel, because she really does a great job in showing you what's going on and how to defend against it. Just a thought. All right, let's go to the callers now. And next up is Rebecca from Tennessee. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a little bit of a long question, so I'll try to get through it quickly.
Okay.
So I don't know if you remember last spring, right after the death of George Floyd and when the Black Lives Matter movement kind of exploded, and, you know, there was stuff all over the internet and things like that about, like, we need to educate ourselves about what Black people have been going through and what their history has been in the U.S. and that we need to educate ourselves so that we know how to respond, how to treat people, et cetera.
Okay, are you referring to something? Just for my clarity, Rebecca, pardon me for interrupting, but are you saying this is something that I said last spring, that we need to educate ourselves about what's going on? Is that what you're referring to?
No.
Or did you,
well,
somebody else told you that?
You said that's something that the media has been posting all over the internet.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That it's the job of white people to educate themselves
about what black people
have been going through. Anyway,
right.
that's a little bit beside the point from my question, just because I agree that we need to be understanding and we need to be respectful of, you know, what they've been going through. Anyway, the main point of my question is I have a brother-in-law who recently came out as homosexual, and we have listened to all your and Alan's discussions and talks and advice on how to interact with him and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I recently had an interaction with him where he was referring to a gay rights event that was going on that he wanted to attend, and I didn't recognize the name of it. I kind of looked at him with confusion, and then other people in the group were kind of saying, well, it sounds like you need to educate yourself, Rebecca, and you need to, you know, like, learn more about this, and you need to, you know what's going on, and you're being a little ignorant and things like that. So I guess the question is, do we have the same responsibility to educate ourselves on, like, gay rights things, to be more understanding and to be able to interact with people that we love who are living the homosexual lifestyle?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Am I making sense?
Well, this is a challenging question, and because I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, on the one hand, it is always appropriate to be sensitive to people who have experienced some measure of suffering for some aspect of their life, especially if it's a controversial aspect of their life. To be sensitive to one's suffering, okay, and especially if they have a different point of view than we have, to be cordial and sympathetic, and to try to understand their view, even though we don't agree with it. Okay. In fact, if we, it's hard to disagree with a view we don't understand. So it's important to understand right. that. So there's a role, but I think that sometimes that can be overdone. And here is just a, it's a cult, it's an observation about the culture right now, Rebecca. You hear this word conversation a lot. Okay. In other words, we have to have a conversation. We need to have a cultural conversation. Okay. Now, the concept of having conversation with people who disagree with us is fine, but I actually think that the way it's being used now is manipulative, okay? Because when, let me just call it the secular environment or the left on these issues, when they talk about conversation, they do not mean conversation. They mean, let's talk about this thing the way I talk about it. In other words, their view.
Mm-hmm.
Let's affirm it. Oh, you disagree? Okay, well, then the conversation's not over yet. We have to keep having the conversation until you get it, until you see it the way we see it. And we're going to keep pressuring you and browbeating you with it until you agree with us. I mean, I can think of conversations I've been in with people, and they've said, well, you're not listening to me. And my response is, of course I'm listening to you. I just don't agree with you. And mm-hmm. what my sense is they're saying, you're not listening because I haven't changed my mind yet. No, I'm listening. That's not hard. This issue is not difficult. We have a different point of view on this. And so there, I think there is a limit then to what can be expected of us in terms of bending over backwards to have conversation and to understand the plight of people. And plus, you know, and I'll let you jump in here in a second because you started to say something and I want to hear from you too. But there is a huge, I'm trying to think of the most polite way to put this. There is a huge wave of victimhood that has been encouraged, that has been abetted, the wave of a sense of victimhood that has been abetted by propaganda and rhetorical tricks. I'm not saying there aren't victims out there, but this has been so overdone and so overmagnified that it distorts what the truth is about the circumstances. There is absolutely no sense that any conservative person is a victim. Even though I just listened to Kevin Sorbo last night doing a thing for Prager University, talking about, you know, he went for 7 years, his Hercules show was the most popular show in the world. And his agent and his manager came to him and they said, we cannot represent you anymore. I mean, this guy's 60 movies. I mean, there's a cash crop here for managers and agents, right? They said, we cannot represent you anymore. He said, why not? Because you're a conservative and you're a Christian. We're firing ourselves. I mean, it boggled him, but this is what's happening. So is he a victim? Does that count? When Hollywood cancels somebody out, what about our stories? They are not interested in our stories because they do not care about how we feel or what befalls us for our views. It's our own fault. That's their perspective. Okay. And so I guess in summary, and then I want to hear from you, Rebecca, is that I think that there is a legitimate place for what you described, but I think that the demand that is being made is excessive and it's a one-way street as it always is with these people. It is completely one-way street. There are rare exceptions to that. But as a generalization, this is the way it is. Whether it's the press, whether it's Hollywood, whether it's the Academy, whether it's whatever, no matter how you cut it, that's the way it is. It's a one-way street. And this happens also in families. In families, because they're taking their cues from the rest of the world, and it's working. The rhetorical propaganda game plan is working just fine. Why should they change for you? So I think that's what you're up against, Rebecca.
Yeah, it's a really difficult, I guess, to use your word, conversation to have. The other difficult part about this is that, you know, he, like, to try to get it to go both ways and to be understanding in both ways, you know, he grew up in a Christian home.
Yeah.
You know, my in-laws are Christians, and he mm-hmm. decided that that wasn't for him and that he okay. didn't want to submit himself to God's law anymore. And so he said, you know what? I believe that I'm gay, and I understand that that's not okay with Christians, so I'm walking away from Christianity. So there's, you know, in this specific instance, there does seem to be a little bit of understanding that, that, you know, because of the choices that we have made to be Christians and to follow God's law, that we don't agree with his lifestyle.
So is he sympathetic to your view for you, so to speak, or is he like condescending about it because you don't support, i.e. affirm, the choices he's made?
I would say a little bit of both. You know, it's kind of an understanding that we have with each other that, you know, we have our beliefs, he has his beliefs. Often it just doesn't come up because it, you know,
trying
to avoid.
Well, that's better than usual. I mean, a lot of times what's going to happen is you'll be ostracized in the relationship because you're not celebrating the direction he's
right.
going.
And to be honest, when it comes to the point of, you know, he doesn't have a partner right now, but when it does, that I think that is when we're going to be pushed away, ostracized, condescended to, mm-hmm. all of that.
Well,
because at that point, then we're going to have to draw the line in the sand and say, I'm sorry, we won't be at a wedding. We won't, you know, affirm this choice of yours.
Yeah. Well, if that's what's required, like they want you to go to the ceremony, I wouldn't even call it a wedding because it doesn't amount to that. And I'm not trying to be hard-nosed. I just don't think those are real marriages. In any event, you can still be gracious, still have relationship with the couple, because we don't expect non-Christians to live like Christians. Yet at the same time, they should, and now I'm just asking for fair play, which doesn't usually happen, come about, they should not expect Christians to believe like non-Christians. You know what I'm saying? And so that's a kind of a two-way street, but it rarely works that way. Usually it's one way. The only other thought I had, and I got to go to break here. I got a couple more callers before the end of the show, is that, and this is just something to pack away, if they bring up the thing, a conversation, we need more conversation, I want to know what that conversation looks like. And maybe that's the question. Okay, what does that mean? What does conversation mean? I know what it means mm-hmm. in practical terms with these folk. It's a one way. It's my way or the highway. That's their view. Or else it's not an adequate conversation unless they can persuade you. So anyway, just something to think about. Ask them, what does that look like? You know, what do we need to converse about? You know my view.
Right.
I know your view. So where is the place for conversation on this issue? You know, you might ask them that. All righty?
Okay.
Rebecca, thank you for your call. Oh, you're welcome. Glad to talk to you. Thank you. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. More to come.
The world says you can be a boy or a girl. You can be gay or straight. You can be cis or trans. There's no right or wrong way to define yourself. No one can tell you who you are. You decide who you want to be, and whatever that is, it can change whenever you want. That's because your identity is untethered to reality. It's chaos. But you don't have to listen to the world. You can listen to a different account of who you are, one told by your maker. And this one is anchored to reality and will bring you from chaos to clarity. Don't miss this year's reality conference. Go to realityapologetics.com to get dates and locations for the student apologetics event of the year.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible content each week? We rely on generous donors so that we can provide you with the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including our apps, blog posts, articles, and short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. Just visit str.org/donate to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources for more than 27 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Help us continue by making a financial gift today at str.org/donate.
Incidentally, one thing I forgot to mention about Reality Apologetics coming up, season starting September 24th in Orange County, is we need volunteers for all six realities, whether Orange County or Seattle or Minneapolis or Dallas or Philly in March or Augusta in April. We need volunteers. So if you would like to help us out at any of those events, just get in touch with Kyle. That's K-Y-L-E. At str.org, Kyle at str.org. From what I understand, people who have helped us out in the past, they have a ball, so we'd like to include you. Let's quickly go to Castaic and Mike. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, thanks, Greg. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I sure can. I heard a little echo, so I don't know if you're on speakerphone. Why don't you just pick the phone up if you are. Sounds like everything's okay now. Hey, by the way, I've spent many hours fishing on your lake up there in Castaic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I actually watched a derby take off the other night. So they had a bunch of guys in their high-speed boats flying around. It's pretty cool.
What happened?
It was a fishing derby.
And, oh, a fishing derby. Oh, yeah. That's right. Crazy. Well, there's some very big fish there. It's one of the few lakes in the world in the history of bass fishing that has produced a bass larger than 22 pounds, a largemouth bass. I think there's only four fish over 22 pounds that have ever been. Maybe only, I think there's only about four or five over 20 pounds. So Castaic is one of them. Anyway, that's another issue, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what's on your mind, Mike?
Hey, I'm curious what your philosophy is on discipleship.
Uh-huh.
And especially with regard to what you're doing with strategic partners, which, you know, I'd like to become one, but I wanted to find out how you flesh discipleship out in your training of people.
Yeah.
STRU or whatever.
Sure.
All that. What does that look like?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question and very close to my heart. And one of the first verses that I remember remembering was 2 Timothy 2:2. And there Paul says, "The things which you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men," and there he means people, "who will be able to teach others also." So in this particular passage, this is 2 Timothy chapter 2, the second verse, and this is the last book that Paul wrote. So this is his swan song. He's going to be executed very soon after he pens this letter to his own disciple, Timothy. And he is instructing him about the skeleton structure. That is, you take the things that you have learned from Paul, so Paul's one generation, Timothy's the second generation, you entrust to faithful people, third generation, who will be able to teach others also, fourth generation. So the point is that they're taking a body of information, and then they are not just throwing it at somebody, they're entrusting it to them, who can then entrust it to others. So the people that are being entrusted with the information realized that it is a trust. In fact, in the first chapter, Paul tells Timothy, "Guard through the Holy Spirit given to you that which has been entrusted to you." Okay? So I'm emphasizing this because it's a really important part of discipleship. What he is describing there is discipleship, and it is a kind of a passing of the baton. And the baton is something with content that you are giving over to someone in a fairly direct way so they can carry that thing on to the point where they pass it to the next person. So I think the baton pass is a great metaphor for this kind of thing. So, and I was discipled by when I was a brand fairly new Christian. I was about 5 months old, 4 months old in the Lord, when I began my relationship with Craig Englert, who is a retired pastor in Maui right now, and he entrusted things to me, a way of life, a way of thinking, and it's not, it can't always be quantified. A lot of these things are caught and not taught. Well, they are taught, but they're also caught. That's the point. And the nature of the relationship is so people can not only get taught, but catch this as well. Okay. So like the relationship that I had with Craig, I have had face-to-face relationships with dozens of groups of people over the years. And they started very soon after my relationship with Craig more formally ended. I right away gathered a group of younger Christians to myself, and we worked together. And that's been my pattern ever since. And now that face-to-face kind of personal interactive thing is directly with my staff, my team of people, not just my young guns, my content providers, but all of our staff. We just had a mentoring time for a half an hour or so today with them. And then that is also passed on to other leaders, other authors or ministry leaders that I have a personal relationship with, so I can have, in a sense, a face-to-face kind of investment in their life. And that model of discipleship, I think, is the primary one. Now, what Stand to Reason is doing in the other venues or methodologies or whatever that you mentioned is similar but different. So the first and the most important kind of discipleship is that interactive personal thing. And that has been my way with our team, or people like Scott Klusendorf, who's now at LTI, or Steve Wagner, who's at Justice for All, or J. Warner Wallace, who's got Cold Case Christianity now, or Brett Kunkel, who's now over at Maven. So this is a kind of a passing on of one's spiritual life to someone else, and the best way to do that is an interpersonal interactive relationship where you spend time together. Okay, but that isn't the only motif for passing that baton. And so as I look at Stand to Reason, from very early on, we adopted the ambassador motif. So our goal was not just to pass information on in a certain kind of generalized sense, like you would if you wrote a book. People read your book. They get the information from the book, okay? If you gave a lecture, people listen to the lecture or talk or sermon and they get information from that, okay? That's just passing information on. So that's giving knowledge. But we wanted to do more. You know this, Mike. We wanted to create a certain type of person. We wanted our approach to be incarnational. And so that kind of person is called, you know what they're called, right? Hello?
A disciple.
It's an ambassador. It is a disciple, but in Standard Reason language. I was just giving you a chance to jump in there, but I caught you by surprise. So, but I know you've been around long enough. You know that we have an ambassador model, knowledge, wisdom, character. And so we're building somebody who has the knowledge, but also has the tactical wisdom to maneuver with the knowledge and has the kind of character that commends the message, not detracts from the message. So our organization, and actually the change fell into the meter for me just about 4 or 5 years ago. What we were like crazy, 28 years now, so 5 years is 23. You know, it took me 20 years before I really consciously was aware of what we were doing. And what we were doing all this time is discipleship. Our mission statement starts with these words: we train Christians. That's what we were all about. I wasn't thinking about discipleship when I penned those words, but I realized it was just coming right out of my DNA. You know, it was just coming right out because that's how I had been formed as a younger Christian, and that's how I began in whatever way I could as I grew, forming others, passing it on, passing that baton, and I realized that's what Stand to Reason does. So the difference, though, with this kind of mentoring that the organization does is it's not so much interpersonal. the way other discipleship, the first style of discipleship is, which I think all Christians should be doing, even members of my own team. Who is it, you know, and I need to pursue this more aggressively with them, but who are the people that you can name that are people you're investing yourself in personally to build them up as younger Christians and pass that baton to? And, of course, they all have families, and so their kids, most of them do, and the kids would be the first people in line for that kind of thing, but even beyond that. So, but the second order of discipleship is kind of trying to pass on this incarnational model, but at a digital distance, maybe the best way to put it, at a digital distance. Now, the advantage that I have, which is unique, is that I have a radio show, or I have the podcast, and more people have these. But when you have a radio show and people are listening, they're hearing in your ear, in their ear, what you're saying, there's an intimacy in that environment that you don't have with TV, for sure, and you don't have with the written word. You are maybe listening in your car, or you're listening at home, or you're listening in your headsets where you're doing other things and cleaning the house, but the person who is speaking is right in your head. That's intimate. Somewhat, even though there's a digital distance, there's still a personal element there. So I find that I can have a different kind of effect on the air in somebody's life than I have, you know, through writing or speaking because of that intimacy. It's kind of like halfway between the two models, you know, and I think that has an effect on people. That's why so many people tell me, I feel like you're a mentor to me, even though we've never met. And so what are the ways we're communicating that? Well, we're passing that information on. Well, the show is a big way, and the solid grounds that I was just talking about, I think about mentoring you, Mike. I mean, not Mike from Castaic by name, but Mike's from Castaic kind of people. Individuals. Whenever I send out a mentoring letter or a solid ground, I want to be building you up, to be passing the baton to you guys, so that that you can stand tall. And this is what we're doing with other methodologies like the Red Pen Logic, which Tim just talked about in the last spot before this final segment. It's what we're doing with STRU. We're looking for all of these different kinds of ways to pass the baton effectively, to take the things which we have learned from the ones who came before us and pass it to the next generation, entrust it to them, this faithful people, so that they can then instruct others also. And that's really, that's the lifeblood of STR. This is what we live and breathe, essentially. Even though, like I said, it was only about 5 years ago, the change fell into the meter, and I really consciously thought about what we were doing. But it's what I was taught from the very beginning, and I just was living that out. And I'm hoping that people like you, Mike, and everybody else who loves the Lord, follows Jesus, will not only be a disciple themselves, but reproduce themselves in other people.
Right. Yeah, my concern is what I see going on is, you know, this what I think is somewhat of a false discipleship, because it's all that's being done is, you know, you take a young guy or you get yourself linked up with an older guy and you go through a book, you know, and he teaches you out of a book. And I just find that to be extremely lacking. What I see in the Bible is Jesus walking and his disciples walking alongside him or behind him and with him, you know, for 3.5 years or so, and they lived life with him.
Right, and, right. Well, that is the ideal thing, but keep in mind that was a different culture and there were different kind of modes that were available to them. And Jesus did teach them, but Jesus didn't need a book. He was the book, okay?
Yeah,
right. I am sympathetic to – just think of all the people who would like to be better at discipleship but don't feel adequate to the task the way you described. Well, I want those people to begin the process. And if that means that in relationship with another individual, they're going through a book together, in my view, that's still discipleship. And it's the best kind in the sense that they're side by side, shoulder to shoulder. There's interaction there. There's talking. There's ways in which the discipler can personally pass things on, even though the foil for that relationship is a book. They can still pass those things on to the less mature Christian, the one that's being discipled. So it may sometimes that may be the only thing that an individual can offer. Even Craig Englert, I mean, he discipled for years and years and years and years and years, 30 years after me. And he still had a kind of curriculum that he would go through. Every year he'd have a new group of people. And he would go through these particular things, trying to build a foundation into them, but still at the same time being with them, which is really key.
Right.
And this is what you're pointing out that Jesus did. Jesus was with them. A book that I read many years ago, and I just bought another copy. I don't know what happened to my original. I wish I still had it. But it's called The Master Plan of Evangelism by Robert Coleman. And he does a great job of describing how Jesus structured a plan to win the world. And that was through the multiplication of discipleship, working with a small group that then worked with a small group that then worked with a small group. And you get this geometric expansion. I have a friend who's building churches that way right now in India, and his goal was 100,000 churches in 30 years. Well, he's got 34,000 churches, and they're rapidly multiplying now because he's using the same plan. Anyway, that's all I got time for, Mike. I really appreciate your call, so thank you for giving me a chance to explain some of these things, and also thank you for considering being a strategic partner. I hope you do that. Thank you so much, friends, for listening. I'm Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.